welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 294 of the podcast. Today, I have an interview with Lisa Cron about her latest book, Story Genius, How to Use Brain Science to Go Beyond Outlining and Write a Riveting Novel. And the challenge, of course, is really about getting emotional with your books and getting deep into character point of view. And Lisa is super enthusiastic, loves talking about story. And we have a really interesting discussion because her book has a few things in that I found quite challenging. She uses the word incendiary quite a lot because what she's saying does actually challenge a lot of the craft books out there, and she has some quite strong words to say about those. So definitely a really fun interview. Lisa is just brilliant, and a number of you requested that I interview her again. She was on the show a couple of years ago when Wired for Story came out, and is back on the show now, so really excited to have her back. Once again, this is a pre-recorded intro, but this is the final one. And as this airs, I will either be at an eco lodge by the Dead Sea or perhaps in Jerusalem. Not quite sure where I will be as this goes out, but I am heading home this week back to Bath. So this will be my last pre-recorded intro, which means next week will probably be a really long one. So watch out for that. If you want to see photos from my Israel trip, check out my author page, facebook.com/JFPenAuthor, where I will be sharing pictures and also videos. And also you can check out jfpen.com/now, N-O-W, where I keep a running diary of my fiction author life. And there will be links there to the albums and videos and everything there. Once again, no emails or tweets this week as this is pre-recorded, but I will be responding to you personally if you do tweet me at The Creative Pen or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com. And as ever, I love to connect with you personally, so thank you for sending those in. Today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and a word from our sponsor coming up soon. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, and I'll be reading out a whole load of new patrons next week. So thank you for your support. If you do support the show on Patreon, even just a couple of dollars a month, you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, and there is a whole year's worth for you to download if you do support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, thank you. Here's a word from Kobo, and then we'll be into the interview.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Nathan Maharaj, Director of Merchandising for Kobo. As Kobo's head bookseller, I'm thrilled to be working alongside the Kobo Writing Life team as they usher in the new era of digital publishing. One of the most exciting trends I'm seeing today is self-published authors and hybrid authors who are climbing out of the 99-cent price band to offer their work for prices comparable to titles from major publishers. These authors have clearly made investments to make their ebooks the best they can be, from cover design and copy editing to thousands of hours of scribbling away honing their craft. And they're not afraid to ask a competitive but fair price for their work. However you publish, it's a great time to be a writer and an even better time to be a reader. I hope to see you on Kobo soon.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com. And today I'm here with Lisa Cron. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Joanna. It's so great to be here. I can't begin to tell you. It's just so strange. I'm so far away, and yet it feels like we're in the same room.
I know. It's very cool. Just in case people don't know you, just a little introduction. Lisa is a story coach and the best-selling author of Wired for Story, and now her new book, Story Genius, How to Use Brain Science to Go Beyond Outlining and Write a Riveting Novel Before You Waste 3 Years Writing 327 Pages That Go Nowhere. That's a hell of a subtitle, Lisa.
It sure is. Oh. man, it really is. It's like, can you say it without running out of breath? I think
it's pretty hard, but we're going to get into the book in a minute. But you were first on the show in 2012, and I can't believe like it's 4 years later. And
I know,
it's crazy. So give us a bit of an update. You know, what have you been up to? What do you do as your day job? Like, why this book now?
Okay, that's a great question. I appreciate it. From then to now, I've been working with writers in one form or another. I've been teaching. I've been speaking all over the place, which is like so deeply fun because there's nothing more fun than being in a room full of writers talking story. I mean, it is like my day goes by and I start working at like 5 a.m. and end at about 10 at night. And the time just goes by so fast. But what happened was when Wired for Story came out, almost immediately, I started to be asked, okay, well, this is great, but to some degree, it's conceptual. You know, I get what you're telling me. And that was a hard thing actually about writing Wired for Story, which was, you know, it all came from working with writers and reading manuscripts and going, okay, where is this going wrong? Why is it going wrong? And it kind of, it turned into the principles that are in Wired for Story. But I remember when I was writing it thinking, okay, here's 16 different things you need to know concurrently. How do you put that out in a linear way? So I sort of broke it down. But people were coming to me and saying, okay, I get all that, but what do I actually do? Like, how do I do that? How do I take it and put it into a novel where I'm beginning from beginning to end? How do I create a novel that does that as opposed to kind of just seeing if this little thing works or that little thing works or this piece of it? How do I either start from scratch and go forward? Or if I'm already in the middle of something, how can I really tell if it's working or not? How can I apply that so I'm sure that I've actually got something, you know, that's going to rivet readers? And really, honestly, from the very first sentence, because otherwise you tend not to have a reader. So Story Genius became, here's how you take those things step by step from the first glimmer of an idea and come through with the framework, the foundation of the story that you're going to tell, you know, and be able to go forward. And so that's what that book is. It's 100% prescriptive, so that you're doing things all the way through, and you're not doing, although it does have a couple of chapters in the beginning where we're talking about, you know, okay, here is the theory and here's what a story is and here's why. I mean, I tend to think, and I know this is incendiary to say, but writing is just taught wrong everywhere. So this is why, and this is what, you know, you really want to come to and think about when you're writing. And then there are, and I never liked this term, even when I was like in writing classes myself, like exercises, because it always sounds like, okay, but that's separate from what I'm writing. Like I'm going to do an exercise to do something. But now, but what you do throughout the book is you do, again, for lack of a better term, exercises that goes to your specific story. So every single thing you do is specific to the story that you're telling. And kind of the last thing I'd say about it is that, and none of it is pre-writing. Every bit of what you do ends up in your novel, either, you know, verbatim in scene form or giving you that foundation, you know, that goes from beginning to end. And that's the foundation that most people don't even think about, not because there's something wrong with them, but because it isn't taught, because they're not taught to focus on it. They're taught to focus on the external. And that just ends up with, you know, as agents and editors will tell you, 99% of what comes in is just a bunch of things that happen. It's not a story.
Yeah. And that's what I want to come back on, because I had an editor on the show a few weeks ago and he kind of said the same thing, that a big mistake writers do is like, here's a pile of paper, thinking that is a story. And, you know, again, you said you've spent years in rooms talking story with people. And on one side, it's like, yes, we know what a story is. I mean, we're all readers, like, you know, but when you actually write a story, it becomes quite difficult. So let's just get back to basics. What is your definition of story?
Okay, my definition is, and let me just say it once and then let's break it down, if that's okay. And you can stop me at any point because I can certainly go on and on and another thing. But my definition of story is, a story is about how what happens affects someone in pursuit of a deceptively difficult goal and how that person changes internally as a result. And if I could just break that down quickly, it's about what happens, and that what happens, that's the plot. And that is merely the surface of the story. It is not, and I can't say it strongly enough, it's not what the story is about. And it's why Here's another totally incendiary thing. If it was up to me, I would get rid of every story structure book out there, starting with a hero's journey on forward. Because first of all, that's a misnomer. It's not story structure, it's plot structure. And it's starting with just these things that happen. And that inherently gives you an empty shell with no actual meaning. So it's about how what happens, which is the surface, is the plot, how it affects someone, and that's the protagonist. And when we're lost in a story, it really is like, I like to use the term, it's like a Vulcan mind meld with a protagonist. The protagonist is your reader's avatar, and everything that happens in the story over here in the plot gets its meaning and emotional weight based on one thing and one thing only, and that is how it is affecting your protagonist in the moment, feel as they struggle with what to do. And it doesn't mean that it affects them just in general, like, you know, your protagonist can't stand to be cold and over here in the plot it's snowing, so they're going to steal a coat because they don't have one. I mean how it affects them in pursuit of a deceptively difficult goal, which is that, you know, for lack of a better term, plot problem, story problem, because stories are about how we deal with the unexpected. They're about how we deal with something that we probably would really like to just take a nap and it's just going to go away. It's how we solve a problem and how we change. So there's something difficult that they want. If your protagonist isn't struggling, or is they're just having a great time and going from party to party, is anecdote after anecdote, you got one of those piles of pages. So it's how what happens affects someone in pursuit of a deceptively difficult goal, and then how that person, the protagonist, changes internally as a result, how their worldview changes. And that is what the story is actually about. In other words, story isn't about the plot. Stories about how the plot affects the protagonist. Story's internal. It's not external. It's about that internal change. What would it cost us to make that change that we have to make in order to adapt to what's happening outside? Mm-hmm. And if you're thinking, when I say to writers, well, like, change from what to what? Like, what does that mean? That's why before you can even create the plot, you have to figure out those two things that a protagonist, all protagonists, enter the story with already fully formed. Something they want really, really badly. And then what I call a misbelief that usually was deeply ingrained early in life, that's actually what's keeping them from getting it. And the story is about how the plot then forces them to go after that thing that they've wanted long before the plot started. Mm. But to get it, they have to overcome this misbelief, to have a chance of getting it and to see things differently. So that's basically my kind of long, my big nutshell version of what a story is.
Yeah, and it's so funny because I was on Facebook earlier on a forum, mm-hmm. and this author was ranting about someone else stealing his ideas. And this was a well-published author complaining, wow, about a TV program stealing his ideas. And I didn't say anything yeah. on it, because, you know, why I'm bringing this up is so many people think that there's originality in the idea. And what you've just described as a story, yeah. they're all the same.
They're all the same.
So where is the originality? So people listening who hate the idea of prescriptive story writing, you know, what is prescriptive? What is original? What do we bring that's original?
I think that prescriptive is the story structure books. I think prescriptive is, this is what the shape of a story actually has to look like. And you come, okay, on page 20, this has to happen. On page 100, this has to happen. Here's your end of act two. I don't think any of that is true. Doesn't mean that a finished story might not hit all of those points. But that's not what you come at. It's in how specifically this affects a specific character and how their specific worldview changes. So we get that insight as to what it's really like to have to go through that based on who that character is. And that's where originality comes from. It's funny, I did a book signing a couple of weeks ago, and someone, some man raised his hand and said, I've heard that there's only 7 plots, you know, and it's like, those men who ask questions like that, I hate to say it, but it's like, yeah, okay, well, I said, well, you know, there's really kind of only one story. And interestingly, I think on that level, what most people are writing about is human connection, the cost of human connection. Mm. What does it cost me to connect? Because, I mean, again, when we evolved a couple hundred thousand years ago and our brains had that big growth spurt that we've been told had to do with, you know, analytic thinking, that's when we got the ability to think analytically, which that's true as well. But what evolutionary biologists and psychologists now think is that that's when our brains were rewired and now we need to belong to a group. We really need to belong to feel like we're part of something. Like, they talk about lone wolves. There are even lone wolves with wolves. There's no such thing as a lone wolf. We're all people who need people. And it's that balance of how much of myself can I keep and get what I need, but I've also got to help other people and be part of a group because I can't make it alone. And where is that balance? Everyone, on one level or another, I think, is writing about that. Mm. But the originality comes into this internal struggle. And what does that character bring to it? And that comes from that story-specific lens that they walk onto page one with. The same way you or I, when we come into some new situation, say some external thing is going to happen to us that would be a plot of a story, we're not like tabula rasa. We don't walk in with no background. Everything we do, every choice we make is based on one thing and one thing alone, which is what our past experience has taught us that that means, and based on what we want and what our agenda is. And that's where the originality comes in. That's why you can't copyright an idea. You can't copyright a premise, because a premise is nothing. Mm. A premise is just kind of a thing that happens. It's a way to start, but you have to dig into the why it matters to your protagonist and who that person is from the get-go. And if I could just say one last thing to be very clear, I don't mean like you need to know a lot about your protagonist in some big general, like do a big bio sort of way, which I think is just as worthless as knowing nothing. Thing, because how do you know what matters and what doesn't? They tend to be very shallow. Again, a bunch of what as opposed to why. So it really is digging into that story specific question. What is that misbelief? Where did it come from in their life? What was the moment where it happened? Write me that scene. Usually it's in childhood. And then I could go on and on and on. To answer your question, I'd go far beyond. I think that's where originality comes from. And that's why, I mean, think of love stories. There are a bazillion of them, you know, and some feel formulaic, like, oh my God, I've already seen that 12,000 times. You're not giving me any inside intel. You're not giving me a fresh way to look at it that I wouldn't have thought of or seen. That's what we come for, that fresh inside intel that I can now use either to guide my life better or so that I understand the people around me. And I notice that when I work with writers, it's like all of a sudden they're going, wait, what's my defining misbelief? And suddenly they go, I understand the people in my life so much. You know, for better or worse, you understand them so much better because you don't know just what they're doing. You really have an idea of that deeper why. And the last thing is often, almost always, that deeper why is completely different than what it looks like on the surface. And that's what we come for. Here's what you're saying. What are you really thinking? Because those two things are often not the same thing.
Yeah. And I agree with you on that. And when I was reading your book, I was kind of reflecting on the books that are memorable to me. And the books that are memorable to me are different to the ones I would say are more like fast food. Now, I read, right. I like Lee Child, Jack Reacher. I wanted to bring this up because Jack Reacher is described as a lone wolf and there is no change in the protagonist. Jack Reacher arrives with a toothbrush in a town. He acts like John Wayne.
Right.
And then he walks out the town and he hasn't changed. The situation has changed. So I wondered what your opinion was in these episodic series books where, and I have a series characters and they go on adventures, but they can't change too much because I want to have lots of books. You know what I mean?
Right.
So how, and I agree with you when it comes to the bigger sort of standalone books, but how do we do that with a series that might go on for a long time?
I think there are whole layers to that answer. So I mean, first of all, again, you need the lens that character walks onto the page with and how they're analyzing things, because that's how we make sense of things. But I think in most series, Jack Reacher, notwithstanding, although I read The Killing Floor, and it felt to me like I got a lot of his, you know, for lack of a better term, because I think it's one of those really misunderstood terms in writing, backstory, meaning the lens through which he's seeing things. So whether he changes or not, we need insight into why he's doing what he's doing and into how he's making sense of what's, especially in a mystery, because we come for how are they going to figure that out. Mm. But I think in the deeper ones, there is some change. I mean, I really like, I haven't read all of them, but Elizabeth George's Inspector Linley series. And one of the things she said, because I love this quote, she said, I chose to do a series because as a reader, I love series. Mm. And I mean, I do too. My big love growing up were mysteries. I love Raymond Chandler. I love, you know, I love them. But she says, you know, I love series. I always have, ever since I was a child, just like me, but only series where the characters move and change through time. And that is the point. They are moving. They are changing. And I think, you know, even even the characters where they don't change, like James Bond or Poirot or Jack Reacher, they're still making sense of things based on their past. And the more you like them, the more you kind of do go into their past. I think same thing, Sue Grafton, she said of Kinsey Malone, you know, her, and she's got, I mean, she's going to have, we're going to have to get a new alphabet.
Yeah,
right?
She's got 26 now, I think. Yeah,
exactly. What's she going to do? And she said, you know, Kinsey doesn't change so much, but the reader learns more about her. And this is the key part, and how she sees things.
Got you.
And that's what we're talking about. So I think at the end of the day, there's that. And the other part of it is that if you are writing some kind of a mystery series or a thriller series, you know, like Jack Reacher or you know, A is for, you know, for whatever, or any of them, you need to know these same questions about, you know, for lack of a better overarching term, the perp. The bad guy, because that's what we come for. We just don't want to see that they did some horrible thing. We want to know why. What did they believe that made that be okay? Mm. What happened in their lives that's allowing them to see things so drastically differently than the way that we do? And I think that I just read a book. It's called, I'm looking at it right over my shelf. It's called Perfect Days by Rafael Montes. And he's Argentinian. And and it's about a guy who's a psychopath, and it's told in the first person, and he doesn't change like at all. He probably can't, but just being in his skin and seeing how a psychopath would read things differently than the way hopefully you or I would read them is riveting. That's what makes it interesting. How are they making sense of it? Mm-hmm. And we don't make sense of things in general, like in some sort of general, we've all got the same rule book. We make sense of things based on one thing and one thing alone. And that's what our past experience has taught us. And so the story is creating your protagonist's story specific past that then leapfrogs into the story. The plot comes out of this almost always. Again, scenes from there are in the story, and the thoughts, the memories, story specifically, are laced into every single page. It's one of the ways writing is taught wrong. People are, oh, backstory, you don't put that in. You know, there's one I've heard, you know, you don't, somebody very big in the writing circles will say, you don't put any backstory in the first 50 pages. It's like, and I think, have you ever read a book? I mean, I could name you off the top of my head, you know, 10 books that not only do that, but do that on the first page. Mm. Because that's what we need. It's just that they do it artfully. What all of that advice tends to mean is just don't do it poorly. Like, I totally agree with that. Don't do it poorly.
Yeah, but don't info dump.
Well,
don't just,
right.
Yeah, that's what
Well, don't
means.
Tell us for the sake of telling us the way it's there is because the character is making sense of what's happening in the moment on the page. They've always got to make a difficult, hard decision in every scene that they're in. And the way they make that decision is to dig down into why this matters to them and what that hard, often, you know, moral choice needs to be. And so that's what we're looking for. And you can't know that without diving into these things first. And that's how you get, you know, completely what your story is about. And again, I could go on and on and on. So that's the answer to that. And another thing.
Yeah. And another thing. Well, and then thinking about this, again, you know, a lot of people in the indie author space write a lot of books. And when you're talking about what the story is really about, I think this often comes down to what the author cares about. And there are often themes that come out over and over again in an author's work. So for me,
most authors.
Yeah, I mean, for me, good versus evil comes up over and over again. Is good versus evil what the story is really about? Or what do you mean by what the story is really about rather than just the plot?
Well, the story is about how the character changes. I mean, the story is about, and that's where we're in that person's skin. I mean, literally, biologically, when you're lost in a story, same areas of your brain light up that would light up if you were doing what that main character is doing. Maybe that's why we liked 50 Shades of Grey. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the point is that internal making sense of change. That's how you make the point. You don't make it in some big external thing because that's a surface world. We live in the surface world. We get the surface world. We understand that completely. Mm. What we want to know is what's going on beneath the surface. So yeah, it would come down to figuring out what's your point, but then how does that play out specifically in the story that you're telling? It's not just good versus evil, because so what? What point are you making about good versus evil? Mm. You know, in what way is good? What defines good? What defines evil? evil as far as you as a writer is, you know, is concerned. What are you trying to say? Why does it matter to you? And then what would this character's conflict be where they would be pulled toward, you know, the for lack of a better term, you know, evil side? Like, where is that internal moral struggle? And that's what you would really figure out. And then it's personified within that character's, you know, arc going, you know, going through your novel. But that's what you need to know. Otherwise, you just have a bunch of hard things happening and the character's reacting for surface reasons. And what happens is then you have a plot and the character has to react in the way the plot demands them to. And now you don't have individual characters. You have plot puppets. Yeah. And this keeps it the other way around because all stories at the end of the day are character driven. Every story is character driven. It's that old thing, oh, well, literary novels are character driven and, you know, and mass market is plot driven. Could not be less true. Sure, mass market might have bigger, more things blow up, maybe, not always, you know. I mean, a lot blew up in The Goldfinch, but it's still all about that internal struggle because that's what we come for and that's what you want to nail and that's where that good versus evil comes down to because everything else is just conceptual. We don't live in a conceptual world. We live in a specific world, you, me, everybody. And you know, and everything out there, good versus evil, we actually only care about it based on how it's going to affect us given our agenda. Otherwise, it's just some conceptual thing and we try to focus on it and we find that we're really thinking, I'm hungry. I wonder how much longer till lunch. You know,
that's great.
That's how we feel it.
Yeah, that's really useful. So you mentioned 50 Shades of Grey there, and you do mention it in the book, and a quote from the book.
Yeah.
We don't come to story for beautiful language, poetic writing, or even dramatic plot points. So, you know, why has 50 Shades of Grey sold 100 million books, and The Goldfinch, which won literary prizes, I think it won the Pulitzer, right? Why is that? I think that is now voted or whatever. They found it was the number one book that people bought but didn't read.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Although I have, full confession, I read both. I love The Goldfinch. I deeply loved it. It had totally flawed. But I mean, the reason is because we don't come for beautiful language. Because what does beautiful language even mean? Like, what is language? When people go, we're talking about that, like a wordsmith, which is a term that makes me gag, like, honestly. Because what are words? Don't have any meaning by themselves. It's a conduit. You know, a word is an empty vessel. What makes a word beautiful isn't the sound of it, it's the meaning it conveys. And that's where story comes in. So 50 Shades of Grey grabs us and we are in
Anastasia.
We're in her skin, literally. I mean, anything that's about sex always has, like, you can't talk about it without there being these unintentional double entendres. It's just... You just can't go there without that. But I mean, but it's about something and we care about her and we understand, you know, where she's confused. We understand what she wants. We understand what it's going to cost her. And that yanks us all the way through. Is it poorly written? I mean, oh my gosh, Donald Moss and I did a thing. We both blog on the Writer Unboxed. And so we did a thing. It was supposed to be called 50 Things Writers Can Learn from 50 Shades of Grey. And I think we like stopped at 70 some just because, you know, like we had to just go, okay, we're just going to stop now because we could go on forever. But I did one I did one of those, you know, those Amazon searches where you can see like how often something is repeated in a novel. I mean, she says holy crap like 40 times.
Am I inner goddess?
Yeah, inner goddess. I mean, I said, like, if you used inner goddess for a drinking game, you'd be in rehab before you were halfway through the book. It's like, by good writing standards, it is really poorly written. But it grabs people because it's a story and because we care and because she made us care. Even as part of your brain is going, if she mentions the beige background of something one more time, I'm going to, you know, it didn't matter. You wanted to know. You felt that sense of urgency. And the problem with, I think, a lot of literary novels, I think wasn't there just something, I think, in the Times about, you know, going to that exact point. It wins the Pulitzer and it sold 1,000 copies or 1,500 copies. Because here's the thing about, here, I'll say something totally incendiary. I think the worst big book ever touted and written is Ulysses. I think it is unreadable. I think it is horrible. But one of the reasons I think that it pulls people, that people are afraid to say that they don't like it, goes to something Steven Pinker talks about, which is, you know, the linguist and behavioral psychologist, or I forget exactly what he hangs his hat on the most. But he talks about the fact that, you know, we are wired to want to survive and to survive well. And that doesn't mean, and this is where story goes to, it's not so much about surviving, like, I need enough food or I need enough, but it's surviving in the social world. And that doesn't mean dating. It just means, you know, you and me and everybody we know. how do we survive? And wanting to survive well means seeming smart. And I think that there are a lot of people who want to say they've read books that are hard because it makes you seem smart. I do not mean this in a judgmental sense. Mm. I don't mean like they're trying to fool us. I mean, we've incorporated that in us. So we actually believe that that does somehow make us. So people, I think, are afraid to say, yeah, that was really boring, or that was really awful, or I couldn't do it, or it was work. There's this idea of if it's work, it has more meaning. And my feeling is if you have to work at it, if it's not pulling you in, it's not a story. It's not doing its job. Mm. It entertains you to put your biology literally, as it does, on hold. You leave the real world and you're in the world of the story, because we come to every story asking that one question. What am I going to learn here that'll help me make it through the night? In our cognitive unconscious, we don't think that. And that's what stories do. So if you're working at it, if it's work, it's not a story at the end of the day, which doesn't mean you don't get something, you know. I mean, I think Ulysses was successful back in the day because it has dirty bits in it. And you couldn't publish dirty bits. And I think everybody went through all that stuff to get to those.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
I'm sure I'll get trashed for that, but that's what I think.
Oh, no, I think that's really interesting. And I agree with the kind of work slash fun thing. Like when I, you know, I used to be a business consultant, I worked really long hours. I worked very hard. I used my brain all day, all I wanted at lunch hour and, you know, not that it was ever a lunch hour. Yeah. You know how these things are.
So
and,
true.
And on my commute on the way home and in bed was escapist thrillers.
Right, right. So, but the key thing is we don't turn to stories to escape. Mm. We turn to them to navigate reality, but it feels like an escape.
Yes.
I think the reason that we don't see the power of story is for the reason you just said, which is we love them so much.
Mm.
We love them so much and they make us feel so good that we think that that's what it's about. We start and stop there. It's to escape reality, and it's how to navigate reality. And that's what we don't realize on that level, is we're affected by stories every minute of every day in terms of how we see the world, and we don't know it. That is the scary thing. And the people who know it aren't writers. The people who know it, this is what makes it even scarier, are advertisers, are telemarketers, or if you look at our country right now, politicians. They know how to do this, and writers tend to not. So yeah, story, there's no such thing as mindless entertainment. There is no such thing. We're affected all the time. And it just changes how we see, you know, how we see the world. I think we're affected even more than we used to be for two reasons. One, because there's long form story now in a way that, you know, years ago there couldn't be. And second of all, because we don't interact with people as much as we used to, because we're like right now, you know, here we all are, all you guys out there kind of watching or listening, and Joanna and I, we're, you know, we're looking at each other, but we're not in the same room. So you don't get that much, you know, interaction. So we're used to bringing it in by watching or reading and then projecting that out into the world, because that's what stories, that's what they're for. Mm. So they're far more powerful, I think, than we know. And that's why I firmly believe that writers like you guys out there, you're the most powerful people on the planet, because story is the most powerful communication tool. And, you know, I mean, you're changing people. Your stories change people. That's why you want to figure out, what's my point? How do I want my reader to walk away? What do I want them struggling with? What do I want them thinking about? Mm. You know, that's like the first question. Because writing's hard. So, you know, once you know that, it definitely makes it easier, because you have that sense of purpose.
Yeah. And I agree that, you know, writing is essentially sort of mind control of the reader at the moment they're going through that story. And it's funny you mentioned your American politics. We won't go there, but there's a hell of a lot of storytelling going on. It's like a masterclass in, you know, whatever kind of storytelling. But I want to come back. You keep saying you're incendiary. There was something else that you mentioned, which was Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody loves Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird.
I love Anne Lamott. Yeah,
she's amazing. And she talks about the shitty, and this is a quote, everyone,
right,
shitty first drafts. Yeah. But you disagree with her definition.
I do. And I think that this is where writers make a massive mistake, because yes, you could say all first drafts, and again, we're doing quotes now, so we can swear. It's so cool. When I was a little kid, I loved West Side Story because I could sing like a bat out of hell, which I wasn't allowed to say. And I was like, but it's the lyric, I'm not just saying it. So yeah, I mean, Hemingway, you know, all first drafts are shit. And that's true. They need rewriting. Where Anne Lamott makes a mistake, and I think the writing world makes a mistake, is she says, because it's the shitty first draft, and again, these are her actual words, she calls it the child's draft. And she says, you can let it all out, you can romp all over the place, let anything, you know, come out, like, I hate to say this, like a NaNoWriMo.
Yeah.
It just can come out, because at the end of the day, no one's going to see it anyway. You can go back and rewrite it. And that could not be less true. Because at the end of the day, somebody is going to see it. And that person is you. And you're going to go back and you're going to go, oh my gosh, here's this thing that romps all over. And then you're going to go, okay, it's a shitty first draft. I get it. I'm a writer. No such thing as writing, only rewriting. But the problem is when you go back to rewrite, and again, I'm not saying in any way we do this on purpose, but your tacit allegiance is to what you've already written and not the story you're trying to tell, especially when you're not 100% sure what that story actually is. So writers go back and they're looking for connective tissue. It's like they want to keep as much of what they've got and they're going to try to stitch it together with some sort of like story logic from the outside in, which is impossible to do. So now you've got kind of like a Frankenstein thing, right? And that it made no sense before and now it makes even less sense. And the heartbreaking thing is that's when writers go, I don't know what made me think I was a writer. Like I wrote it and then I threw all this other time in and now it's terrible and I'm going to give up writing and I'm going to take up, you know, like, I don't know, like interpretive dance or something, which you don't, the world has way too many interpretive dancers, like don't go there. But the thing that always killed me about that is that where they went wrong often had very little to do with their ability to write or their wordsmithing and everything to do with their ability to tell a story. Because there's a massive difference between a shitty first draft of an actual story and one that romps all over the place. It's just the worst advice ever, in my opinion. It's what tanks, because then when a writer will go, oh, I'm just letting it all hang out, and then I'm going to come and I'll show it to you. And I was like, oh, don't do that. Don't do that. Let's talk now. Yeah. Because the mistake you're making is right there in the beginning. And now everything after that's going to have to go because you didn't dig down and it isn't really about things. I mean, as when I was in publishing and as an agent, you often feel that writers write something and they give it to you and they're hoping you're going to tell them what it's about. It's about 300 pages. No idea. Just a bunch of things that happen. And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And it's funny when you say it like that, I know what you mean, because I think years and years and years ago when I first tried to sit down and write, you know, it's like, oh, well, just sit down and write what you feel.
Yeah.
But unless you actually learn like what scenes are and how to write from a character point of view and I hate to say structure, but, you know, structure in some form, then, you know, you do end up with a whole load of random stuff. But can we make it more specific? Because, you know, going back to your massive subtitle, go beyond. going beyond outlining to write a riveting novel. Right. So how do we go beyond outlining? And, you know, I know we've talked about a lot of things, but what, you know, something more specific around not throwing it all on the page.
Right. Because you can't, because stories don't begin on page one. That's the big mistake. We read and we think, okay, it's, you know, I read a novel, I start on page one and I get to page 327. When I write, I start on page one. It's a linear form, and it's not, because you don't know what that is. So all stories begin en medias res, Latin for in the middle of the thing. Page one of the novel is the middle of the thing. Mm. The story goes back this way. So the beginning is really to figure out, both because people come with that idea of, okay, here's kind of my premise, here's where I think it's going to go this way. But then it's really digging down and going, okay, why is that going to matter to your protagonist? Because it's not about that. It's about this interchange that they're going to have to make. And it's really digging back to figuring out, okay, what are they interwanting? What is that thing that's going to hold them back, which usually takes you all the way back to their childhood, a misbelief, which is something that grabs them when they're very young. And we all have this. If you start looking at your life, you'll see it. It's kind of terrifying, actually. You know, something that you had some difficult, traumatic, usually psychologically traumatic situation where a belief saved you. It was adaptive at that moment. You know, liked it very quickly, and I won't go into it in depth, but like if you were in a family and you kind of realized in some very specific moment that every time your sister did something nice, kind of unsolicited, she really wanted you to do something that was going to get you in trouble for her. And you come to this moment where you go, okay, wait a minute. The nicer someone is to me, the more they're trying to cheat me. So every time somebody's super nice, that means they want something and now I don't trust them. Now in that moment, that was true. That was adaptive. Mm-hmm. That probably saved that person from something, you know, like a horrible, like homeless. But if you take that belief out into the world and that's how you see things, that is going to steer you wrong for most of your life. because you're not going to trust the very people who do see you and the very people who do care about you. So it is figuring things like that out, again, and this is in very specific detail, and then how that has driven that person's life, also based on what they want, which, let's just say, again, for lack of a better, because this is totally general, like some sort of connection and really being seen. And then they get to the plot, which is now going to force them to go after that. So there's a ton of stuff that you would figure out in terms of that person's life, specifically based on what we just said, not in general, that would lead you up to the beginning and up to that thing that's going to force them to go forward. And then it only goes forward based on how it's affecting them internally, because that's what the scene is. Because that's why I get scared when people think of, okay, well, let me learn to write a scene. Yeah, that's important. But the most important thing to think of is that a scene is like, if you picture, you know, those big, like a concrete bridge over something, like you're driving over it, but it's made of concrete slabs and you can kind of see where the slabs are. You think you got a flat tire going over them because your car goes thump, thump, thump. It's like, think of every scene is one of those slabs. So the scene before leads to the next scene, think cause and effect, that scene is there, and then it leads to what happens next. So coming into every scene, you've not just got what happened before in terms of like plot-wise, but you've got how that's changing your protagonist, why it matters to your protagonist, because in every scene, they're going to go in with an agenda wanting something. And this is an agenda that is story-long from first page to last. They've got all characters have a defining agenda. Everything they do is to make that agenda real. So you know that in every scene, they're trying to advance that agenda. Same thing for every secondary character, which means you need to know specifically what that is. And you need to know how in that scene, they're trying to advance it. What does it mean to them? Then something happens. Scenes are all broken into two parts, every scene. But they come in, the first half is the effect, the second half is the cause, second half is what that changes within the scene. So they come in wanting something that has meaning, they do something, they've got a struggle, they always have to make some sort of tough choice in every scene. That's what takes us to that internality. That's how you get that backstory in. Because with all of us, the way we make sense of things is to look at the past, that's our decoder ring, to try to figure out, what does this mean, really? What's really going on here? And then we think about what we might do. We play it against the future. Is this going to help me with my agenda? And then we make the decision. And that's what you need in every scene and every page. Then they do what they do within the scene. Usually, it doesn't go the way that they want it to. That's where structure comes from. It's internal, not external. And in every scene, they change. In every scene, that aha moment, that change that we're talking about, that they go through, they come in with the mist. Hopefully, the story will disabuse them of that, scene by scene by scene, kind of going back and forth and back and forth. But in every scene, there is a slight change where their agenda has to, how they're going to achieve their agenda shifts a little bit. And that's basically a scene. So this kind of method allows you to do that and figure that out both in the future and kind of going forward. So you don't end up with any, I don't advise anybody ever write a full outline of anything ever without going forward, because it is this internal that changes it. When people write outlines, they can only outline the external. So these two things kind of go hand in hand as you're going forward. And the rest is kind of too complex to sum up quickly in a few minutes. But that's basically it. And there is sort of a card system that helps you map it out as much in the future as you can go and keep track of all these moving parts that you've got, because a story has tons of moving parts. And writers tend to not realize that everyone in every scene has that overarching agenda, every secondary character. And you need to know all of that within each scene to write a compelling scene. But to write a scene like out of order, or just, oh, this cool thing would happen, Never works.
And I do talk about the writing craft being like an iceberg, in that you can write a novel with the little bit that's above the surface, but you can then spend the rest of your life learning all of this type of stuff, you know, and your book has a whole load of really great stuff in. So I totally urge people to get it. One last question before we finish. So you've read thousands of manuscripts probably now, and you've, as you say, you work with Donald Moss. And what we've said is basically, you know, there is an archetypal story. So what do you think is the thing that makes books like The Hunger Games, Harry Potter, 50 Shades, you know, Gone Girl? Is it publishing luck? I mean, because all these stories might have the same elements that are strong, but what does pop, you know, enable a story to pop? do you think?
I think it's the immediacy. It's immediacy. It's something is affecting somebody. We understand what it means to them, not just on the surface, like a meteor is coming at me and I might get killed. Like, we get that. But what it actually, with Harry Potter, what it meant to him in the beginning to be with his aunt and uncle, to have the, I mean, all of it is, we understand that. Gone Girl, we instantly get what's going on with Nick when Amy isn't there. And he talks about it in that opening page. You know, what are you thinking, Amy? I wish I could unspool your brain. What's going on? It's that internality. It's never about what happens. It's about why and how it affects a character and why they do what they do. And they need to be responding. And I think it's actually this in the moment on the page as they struggle with what to do, so that we're feeling that internality of it and we get what this up here is costing them inside and why they're not willing just to say it. Because that's our life. Like Brené Brown's great, her original TED Talk about vulnerability is we're afraid to show even what we believe about. That's why writers have it's so courageous to be a writer, because you're letting the world know what matters to you, you know, and that's what we come for. I think that's actually that's what makes people buy those books and actually read them, because they want to know that, oh my God, you know, out here they think they're doing it for this reason, but I'm inside their skin and I know it's really this over here. You know, how are we going to find that out? That's what pulls us in. And without that, we don't care what something looks like. Sensory details do not bring a story to life per se. It's only when they're there for a story specific reason to tell us something about what's happening and what it means to someone. And if you look, you'll notice it on every single page. That's what does it. It's that making us feel it. Because again, it is that Vulcan mind meld. So if what's happening isn't affecting your protagonist, and I don't mean just happy, sad, and some sort of big, you know, but affecting like how they're thinking about it. How are they going through this and trying to decide what to do? That's where emotion comes from. It doesn't come from happy, sad. It doesn't come from my heart was pounding or my leg was jittering. It comes from how they're making sense of it internally. That's what pulls us in, but only in terms of this tough decision they've got to make in the moment, not like long rambling musings, which is how people do it wrong, or some big general thing that has no application to what's happening. They're thinking about it because the plot is forcing them to in the moment, and then take some action and they're not sure what to do. That's how it works. Watching them make sense of things, I think, is the key thing. And then, yeah, there's a lot of luck. That yeah. said, there is a lot of luck as to what's going to hit and what isn't. And I would guess that with 50 Shades of Grey, you could probably find like a blind taste test, right? And you could probably go out there and find 6 other trilogies. And if they said, okay, read these and tell me which one you think sold 100 million copies, you wouldn't be able to tell.
No.
Because that part's luck. It's just luck.
Yeah, and that's the business of everything. There's luck involved in pretty much everything. So, you know, let's just get on with it. So, fantastic stuff. Tell us, where can we find the book and everything about you online?
Okay, I am at my website is just wiredforstory.com. You can find me there. I have a newsletter that goes out usually every Friday, and I have a downloadable thing that will give you like 11 takeaways, the 11 best takeaways from Story Genius. So you can take a look at that. And then Story Genius is available, you know, Amazon, you know, in bookstores, you know, online, all of the usual places. You will be able to find it, and Wired for Story also.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Lisa. That was great.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always fun, Joanne. I hope we meet again soon.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.